Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and it's the first podcast of the new year. So we've got a special guest for you. It's Joe Tomlinson. How are you, Joe?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. Glad it's 2021. I can't lie. I've just heard the news that the first Oxford vaccine's been stuck in some old geezer's arm. So I'm feeling pretty positive today.
Did you end up having coronavirus over Christmas? Because there was a concern at one stage.
There was a concern. It was a negative coronavirus test. There's been a few coronavirus victims at Football Daily, hasn't there? But I am not one of them. Yet, anyway, touch wood, fingers crossed. But to be honest with you, not really leaving the house at the moment. It's pretty boring life, but it's important to keep everybody safe, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I've got to say, I'm really shocked that Chris Hamill has not had it. He seemed like an obvious candidate, because if there's any disease going around, Chris Hamill will contract it.
Yeah, he is a like a sort of poorly bloke, isn't he? He's got a tummy problem or a cold or like a headache.
Yeah, well, thankfully he's managed to dodge this one. So I think it was only Doogie who fortunately is in like peak physical condition and was able to fight it off using his marathon lungs. So yeah, let's hope that nobody else gets sick before we all get jabbed with this vaccination. And let's be honest, I'm going to get it way before the rest of you because I'm older than the rest of you. So you can also...
Well, I'm asthmatic, mate. I'm asthmatic, so get to the back of the queue.
All right, fair enough. I can pretend to be asthmatic. It's not that hard. shall we move on then? Because obviously the Premier League has had an extremely busy Christmas period. Yes. And there have been loads of stories thrown up. Now, normally, over the Christmas period, we're used to seeing the bigger sides really crush the smaller sides because of the strength of squad. And I kind of thought that would be the case again this year because of the fixture congestion, because of the shortened pre-season, because teams weren't really able to strengthen the way they wanted in the summer. So what I thought we'd do is a little bit of stock rising, stock falling. So that's basically which teams, players and managers have seen their reputations enhanced by their performances over the Christmas period and which ones are in a little bit of trouble heading into the back half of the campaign. Now, Joe, we've had a little think about who we like and who we don't like over the Christmas period. Mm. And I think that we potentially line up on one of our stocks falling. My first stock falling is Big Frank Lampard. And okay, one of yours, I believe, is also a Stamford Bridge resident.
Yes, it is. Do you want to kick us off? I mean, Timo Werner is mine. I'll get rid of that spoiler early doors. Obviously not scored in 12 games now, despite playing an awful lot of minutes in both left wing and now central forward as he played against Manchester City. Struggling pretty badly as well. But yeah, let's go with Lampard to start with because he's in the mud fully, isn't he, at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, like, going into Christmas, you'd have said that, like, if you were thinking about a manager from a top side who might be in a little bit of trouble, Arteta would have been your first port of call. And then after that, I think you would have, even though they've been in pretty good form lately, I think that even somebody like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was probably under more consistent pressure from the press and maybe from the fans than we've seen Frank Lampard get. But after the run over Christmas, where Chelsea took 1 point from three games, things have got really tight. And now we're seeing stories, you know, The Athletic have published a story saying that Chelsea are considering a change behind the scene. I think, in fact, you know, Frank Lampard might even consider himself a little bit lucky that Mauricio Pochettino has accepted the PSG job, because that's one obvious rival to his position kind of out of the picture. But Chelsea did have a tough run over Christmas. They had Arsenal away. Now, that ended up being a tougher game than they probably would have expected. They had Villa, which is a very tough game right now. And then they had Manchester City. But in that time, their expected goal difference was minus 1.4. They conceded 7, so only West Brom allowed more. Only 4 teams had a worse expected goal difference in those 3 games than them. And I think Villa is probably the only game where you could argue they were hard done by. But even then, they invited a lot of pressure. They allowed Villa to kind of play through them. And I think as well, before the Man City match, a lot of people were giving Lampard a little bit of license. They said, you know what? Hakim Ziyech has been out and Hakim Ziyech looks like he's going to be a nailed-on starter in this team. He came back for the City game. They mustered just 9 shots. And, okay, I have issues with how they performed on the pitch. But if there's one thing that I've really, really hated about Frank Lampard as a manager, I hate it. It's his public criticism of players. I think it's really amateurish. I think it it doesn't suit top club. Now, often you see players get sent off or something and managers will say, I'm disappointed. You know, you will see that happen. Like Arteta did that with Pepe and Granit Xhaka. And we've seen that with various managers at different points. But Lampard is the only manager at a top side I can think of right now, even more than Mourinho, who consistently comes out after games and basically implies that he's been let down by his players.
Are you talking about individual players here or the team as a whole?
Well, he certainly said it after the Arsenal game. He was just like, you know, we just weren't at it today. We weren't even trying, blah, blah, blah. And he never seems to suggest he's got it wrong in any major sense. Whereas when I've seen Ollie go through tough periods, when I've seen Arteta go through tough periods, Pep, Klopp, they do tend to say, you know, I got things wrong as well. That's something we're going to have to look at on the training ground. Whereas to bring it back to your stock falling over Christmas, after the Arsenal game, Frank Lampard did specifically single out Timo Werner for criticism, despite the fact that he took him off at half time. Like, we know you're not happy with the player when you take him off at half time. You don't need to go and hang him out to dry as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I don't potentially have as much of a problem with you as singling out the players and some of the team from Frank. I don't think that's necessarily been a huge issue for him because he's also, I've seen a lot of interviews where he's been heavily praising the likes of Kai Havertz, really, I mean, trying to galvanise him, I think, at this stage because he's having, quite frankly, a woeful campaign for Chelsea. I think Frank's biggest problem will be now that Chelsea have a far itchier trigger finger than a Manchester United or Arsenal. And historically have seen massive success from consistent turnaround of manager, which again, Manchester United and Arsenal haven't seen. So I don't think they'll have any problem, even though he is a club legend, moving him on mid-season to look for another boss. And I would be slightly concerned about Allegri and Thomas Tuchel being on the market if I was Frank Lampard. I was speaking to Zach and I was speaking to Sam yesterday. Both of them were like, oh, Allegri's not good enough. Tuchel's not good enough. And I was thinking to myself, I'm not sure the Chelsea board are going to see it the same way, particularly about Max Allegri, to be honest with you, because they'll be looking at this campaign. And I think Frank rightly said yesterday, when you bring in this many new players, you are going to see extreme highs and some quite heavy lows. And let's not forget, a month ago, Chelsea are on a 17-game unbeaten streak. So people were talking about them being potential title challengers then, which is probably too high. And a lot of the criticism right now is probably too harsh. It sits somewhere in the middle. But what would worry me if I was the Chelsea board is that they've taken less points this season than they had at the same stage last season under Lampard. I think they took 29 at this stage last season. They're on 26 at the moment. And I understand it's a very competitive campaign, isn't it? I believe there's sort of 8 points or something separated about first and 10th or something like that. So it is going to be competitive. My issue is the itchy trigger finger. And also, I think Frank is struggling to find the right system to fit the players he's bought in the summer into. Is it a 4-2-3-1? Is it a 4-3-3? Does Werner work as a lone striker? Is Ziyech going to be able to play 40 games a season from the right? Where do Tammy and Giroud fit in? I think there's a lot of questions still to be answered. I don't think he's coming up with many solutions right now. The issue for a lot of Chelsea fans coming into the City game was, you know, Timo's not scoring goals because he's playing from the left. Get Timo through the middle. And I think if you ask Chelsea fans, the majority of which yesterday, when they saw that team lineup, was that the correct team on paper? Is that the right front three that they've wanted to see of Pulisic, Ziyech, Werner through the middle? They'd have all said yes, almost. Maybe they would want to see Havertz over Mount, potentially. But overall, probably 90% the way Chelsea fans wanted to see. And I thought it was one of the most dysfunctional I've seen Chelsea all season. Thought it didn't work at all. I still am backing the campaign. You cannot play Werner as a lone striker in the Premier League. It's not going to work. Way too lightweight. He's not good enough with his back to goal to bring other players into the game. And if you're Chelsea, you just aren't going to get consistent space in behind teams. They are going to sit deep against you. And this kind of myth of, oh, you know, Werner works best in these spaces in behind, that don't exist when you're playing like a Burnley or a West Brom. There isn't space in behind. And City yesterday said, okay, we're not going to give you any space in behind. We're going to let you actually have a little bit more of the ball. And then we're just going to look to almost counter-attack against you, which is what they did at times. And they were unbelievable yesterday, Man City. So I think Frank has an awful awful lot of issues. But yeah, for me, Timo Werner is going to be my stock falling just because, you know, no goals in his last 12 games. I'm looking at his XG now. It's the lowest it's been since 2014, his first season with Stuttgart. It's at 0.45. Last season, we're looking at sort of 0.7s. Even the season before that, 0.6. I'm obviously not writing him off because he is still young, but I have massive concerns as to how he works in this Chelsea system, particularly with Havertz trying to fit in to like an attacking midfield, false nine. Where does he play? I don't know. And it's £100 million spent on those two that don't fit in the same team. So there's a lot of issues. For me, Timo Werner right now is the biggest one, Chelsea.
See, I don't have an issue with Timo Werner at all. And I certainly don't think he's one of the biggest issues there.
I'm not saying he's the problem. I'm saying like,
how you fit him in.
How do you make it work is a massive issue for me.
I do think though that like, I think it's perfectly possible that he's still getting quite a lot of chances. And if he'd scored at the rate that we'd expected, he'd basically be having a totally fine first season. It wouldn't be spectacular, but it would be okay for a first season in the Premier League. And also, you know, you say he's lightweight, but I kind of feel like quite a lot of teams have been okay with a relatively lightweight striker. Like Aubameyang's not good with his back to goal. Jamie Vardy's not good with his back to goal.
But do you think that's
Gabriel
why Aubameyang's playing out on the left?
Pardon?
Like, and I think my issue with... I was trying to think of examples as well. I was actually on the phone to my dad last night talking about this. And I was thinking like, who else plays with this sort of lightweight number nine? Potentially Anthony Martial at Manchester United. Mm-hmm. I don't think it works there. Jamie Vardy, I think he's like a total exception to the rule because he's like a street fighter. Like, just he will battle everybody and anybody. And other than that, like Aubameyang's been shifted out to the left. Like, Bobby Firmino's way better in link-up play. I just don't see that model of centre-forward working in the Premier League at the moment.
But I think it would be less of an issue if the rest of the team was kind of functioning. You know, in the same way that, like, Aubameyang's been shifted out there, I don't think his struggles... I think his struggles at the moment are partially down to his age, but I think they're mostly down to a dysfunctional team.
Do you not think they look more functional when he's not in it? Like, I think Chelsea look more functional when Timo Werner's not in it. Pulisic's on the left, Giroud's through the middle, and Ziyech's on the right.
But I'd say that that's not necessarily about... I'd say that's more of a problem for Frank to solve I think the ceiling on that team is a lot higher with Werner in the lineup than it is with Giroud in the lineup. But I also think it's completely understandable that Giroud currently dovetails with those players much more naturally than Werner does, you know? That said, I mean, even in the City game, there were moments in the beginning of the match where Chelsea looked dangerous. You know, they could have had a penalty quite early on. I thought Rodri was very lucky not to give away, whether it was a penalty or a free kick on the edge of the box. I thought that that was a pretty fortunate decision for City when it was at 0-0. I don't really worry about Werner. I worry, I suppose, a little bit more about Havertz, just because I think he needs to be playing. And while obviously he's going to improve and, you know, adapt physically and he's still extremely young, I worry that it's harder for him to adapt when he's not really playing very much and he's kind of getting shifted around all over the park. Like, Timo Werner, at least, is getting shifted around in positions that he's played before. Whereas, I've got to say that when I've watched Chelsea, the forwards who've really impressed me have been Pulisic, Ziyech, and Callum Hudson-Odoi, I think, has probably deserved a start.
Yeah.
And that is worrying, right? Like, then you're looking at a team where you say, like, what is the plan here? And also, again, you know, I've seen some defences of Lampard saying, well, you know, Werner's not scoring at the moment and Havertz hasn't settled and Ziyech's been injured. But the advantage of having so much depth in attack is that when Ziyech is injured, you can bring in Callum Hudson-Odoi. Like, I mean, Callum Hudson-Odoi would start on the right wing for Man United. He'd start for Arsenal. You know, it seems a little bit strange to... Like, this is not really a defence of Lampard, I think. It's more of a problem with the fact that Frank Lampard isn't getting what he should be getting out of those players.
Yeah, I mean, the form is gutter as well at the moment, isn't it? Like, what is that? I think 1-7, and that was that 3-0 against West Ham that I think everybody can see flattered them pretty, like, enormously. I do believe Lampard is going to turn it around at Chelsea, and I still think that they are very strong top four contenders.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were Chelsea's board, Pat, right now, would you be saying Allegri and Tuchel I just want to get him in now? Or do you think you just give Lampard the season, even if he misses out on Champions League?
I don't think he'll miss out on Champions League. So I suppose I would probably give him the season. I mean, like, the issue that I have with Sam and Zach saying, like, these guys aren't good enough is they're better than Lampard. Like, we can be pretty... Like, Tuchel is a lot better than Lampard. I think Allegri probably is. I don't think I'd hire Allegri. I think Tuchel's a better fit for this talent and probably has a much higher ceiling with this side. Chelsea went out this summer and spent an awful lot of money, essentially to replace Tammy Abraham and Callum Hudson-Odoi in their starting lineup. And their question there wasn't like, oh, well, you know, do these players deserve to be benched? Because I don't think they really did. It was just, can we do better? And it's weird that they're not applying that same idea to their manager. It's weird that they're saying, oh, well, has Lampard done something to deserve being sacked? No, he hasn't really. But can we go and get a better manager? Like, yes, you can. I feel like when they eventually replace Lampard, if they can go and attract someone like a Tuchel, like a Marco Rosa, like a Nagelsmann, which is perfectly possible for Chelsea, I think that you'd say that person's got a really good chance of winning the league. Because when Mikel Arteta was talking about Chelsea the other day and he said, I think this is maybe the strongest squad in the league, I don't really disagree with him. I think at the very least, it's like second. Like, this Chelsea squad is really good and really deep all over the park, except maybe in central midfield. And even then, you know, they've benched Kovacic for long spells of the season. Jorginho's not playing at all. Like, there's tons and tons of talent in this Chelsea side. And I would not be surprised if they got an elite manager in the summer and then suddenly they were genuinely competing for the title. I don't think they're going to win a title under Lampard, basically.
Yeah, I do think they should stick with him, though, is what I will say. As much as, like, we've got them in the stock falling, and stock is falling rapidly, I still think they should stick with Lampard. And I still think eventually Timo Werner will come good. But at the moment, their stock is, yeah, it's pretty low if we're doing stock falling as a podcast topic.
Yeah, I think so as well. But I agree that they can kind of wait till the end of the season. I think they probably get top four. And if at that point they are able to go and get someone like Julian Nagelsmann, then I think, like, at that point you should maybe go and do that. But if you don't like any of the candidates available right now, that's also totally acceptable. Like, we get that. But I think it's something that they should be thinking about. And given Chelsea's history, like you say, they do tend to be thinking about whether there's a better manager out there. That's a consideration that's always kind of in Marina Granovskaya's mind. So shall we move on to something a bit more positive? Should we go on to stock rising? Who have you got who's really impressed you over the Christmas period?
I was trying to have a think about this as not being too biased, because Manchester United have had a pretty positive Christmas period, probably the on-form team in the Premier League alongside Manchester City. But I thought I'd start with a Manchester City player, just because I was so impressed by their performance against Chelsea yesterday. It was one of the most entertaining Manchester City displays I've seen this season, because at times they've looked a little bit un-Pep Guardiola-like, a little bit ponderous on the ball, not too dynamic. But yesterday I thought they were really back to the best Manchester City. I thought Ilkay Gundogan was maybe his best display in a Manchester City shirt this season, or at least last two seasons potentially. Mm-hmm. But my stock rising is going to be John Stones.
Nice.
I think right now John Stones is the best centre-back in the league. And he's getting better by the week. It's really nice to see the resurrection of John Stones. To be able to be benching Laporte is no mean feat, by the way. I think people forget just how good Aymeric Laporte was for Manchester City last season when he wasn't injured, and the season when he first arrived. Because he was, alongside Van Dijk, the outstanding centre-back in the league. Let's have no two ways about it. And can't get a sniff at the moment because of the partnership that Ruben Diaz and John Stones have formed. I don't know whether it's his confidence. I don't know whether it's he's fitter. I read a good article, I think it was in The Telegraph, about how he's basically been training all of the sort of period that he was being left out of the team on his working on his fitness, on his upper body strength and stuff like that. And it seems to be paying dividends. And he's actually got a really nice partnership with Ruben Diaz, who I don't think you would have put the pair together at the start of the season. We would have all said, no, it's going to be Diaz, it's going to be Laporte. that is going to be the starting pairing for Man City. But yeah, man, hats off to John Stones. Nailed on starter now, by the way, for England at the Euros. First name on the centre-back team sheet ahead of Maguire. I think he's been the best centre-back in the league over the Christmas period. And probably this season, given that City had the best defensive record in the league.
Yeah, City, that is something that's kind of gone a bit under the radar, I think, because of their struggles early on in the season. City are now an elite defensive side. They are the dominant defensive side in the league. I mean, they've got 13 expected goals allowed in 15 games. They're the only team in the division who've conceded under one XG a game. And I looked across Europe's top five leagues. Only Atletico Madrid, RB Leipzig, Real Sociedad and Lille have allowed less XG per game than Manchester City. And I actually had a Man City defender in my stock rising as well.
Cancelo, surely.
Yeah, Cancelo. Because yeah. I think he's now finally getting noticed for everything that he's capable of doing in this team. And partially that's because he's only now showing that. But I do think that normally these things start a couple of months. You know, they start and then 2 months later, people start to notice. And I mean, in the Chelsea game last night, he had that just defense splitting pass to Kevin De Bruyne that he should have really finished early on. And I think that that is a perfect example of what Cancelo can bring. I mean, he's been a part of that rock solid defense, but his ability to pass forwards, his ability to slot into the midfield and not look out of place is remarkable. This season, he's creating over 2 chances a game. It's the best of his career. I think he's third in the league for passes into the penalty area per game. Only De Bruyne and Trent Alexander-Arnold are ahead of him. He's ahead of Bruno Fernandes there. And I mean, over Christmas, they obviously had their Everton game postponed. But in the 2 games they played, City created 6.4 expected goals and allowed 0.9. That is genuinely staggering. And, you know, Cancelo is also putting up huge defensive numbers. He's sixth in the league for tackles and interceptions per 90. And this is in a team that has 60% of the ball. Like, I mean, his ability to go two ways, his ability to use either foot, he could play left back, he could play right back. Like we said, he can slot into midfield. He's a great dribbler. He's a really good progressive passer. He knows exactly where to be defensively. I think that he is a part of why we've seen players like Ilkay Gundogan really start to shine. Like, I completely agree. I think Ilkay Gundogan has been underrated pretty much his entire time at Manchester City. But having that little bit of support from Cancelo in the midfield, I think has really, really shored things up. And if he continues to perform like at this level,
yeah,
then I think that City, you know, a title challenge is completely there for the taking.
Oh, like, definitely. Yeah. Definitely, mate. They're getting better week in, week out, Manchester City. They've got players coming back to fitness, the likes of Sergio Aguero. And if they can... The left-back problem has been dogging them for a while now. We all said, didn't we, in the summer, why have they not signed a left-back as well? And it's gets a spotlight shone even more with Angelino's form at RB Leipzig. But I think they're so functional at the back anyway at the moment that they can kind of cover it up. And like you say, João Cancelo is so exceptional on both flanks, really, that he's probably been the outstanding fullback in the Premier League this season, really, alongside maybe I think Reece James had a great sort of breakout first 3 months of the season up to the Christmas period prior to that injury. I'm trying to think of some other names. I think... what's the lad's name at West Ham? Just literally falling out of my mind. The
Talking about Soufal?
Soufal, yeah. Soufal, I think, has been exceptional as well. He's definitely in contention. So there's a few other names in there, but I think João Cancelo has really impressed me. But yeah, I'll go John Stones. Probably because I'm so shocked, more than anything, that this has happened. When there was chat in the summer that he was going to be sold, Pep didn't fancy him, Ruben Diaz got bought for 50 million. I thought, that's probably the end of John Stones. Little did I know, it was actually going to be the resurrection of John Stones. So yeah, he's going to be my stock rising, John Stones.
Yeah, I mean, when your stock gets that low, there's kind of only one way for it to go. But I'm really delighted. I think everyone kind of feels good for John Stones. Because of course, you know, he was also part of the best Premier League side we've ever seen. That Manchester City team that got 100 points. And everyone laughs at John Stones and Nicolas Otamendi. But they were part of that unbelievable defence. So yeah, I think John Stones is a feel-good story. And certainly, as you've pointed out, like, for those of you who are England fans, like, this is a really positive development ahead of the Euros.
Oh, massively so, because the centre-back pairing was becoming an issue particularly with Joe Gomez out for an extended period of time, looking like he's probably not going to go to the Euros following that injury. It was, we're going to have to play a three at the back. Connor Cody is probably going to have to play. No disrespect to Connor Cody, because I think he's been one of the outstanding centre-backs of 2020 as well in the Premier League. His distribution from deep is probably the best in the league after Virgil van Dijk. So I don't have a massive issue with him there. And Harry Maguire, yeah, an absolute meme on social media, but is probably a nailed-on starter for England at the Euros. Extremely consistent, plays pretty much every minute of every game. I think he picked up more minutes in 2020 than any footballer in the world. I saw that statistic. I don't know how they calculated it.
Wow.
Certainly more than any player in Europe. Not sure about South America, but it was like a worldwide statistic. So he will play. Harry Maguire will play for England at centre-back, nailed on. It's who partners him. And at the moment, John Stones, it's like he's going to be that guy if it's not a three-at-the-back system.
Well, interesting that you mentioned Connor Cody, because I think we should move on to another stock falling. And my stock falling is Wolves. Like, I'm a bit concerned about Wolves, because I don't know about you, but I was quite
annoyed. Really? Are you, though? Are you, or is it just until Jimenez comes back?
Well, I don't necessarily know when that is. And I also think Jimenez has got to come back and perform at a high level immediately. And you never want to be in a position as a club where you're waiting for a guy to come back from injury to save you. I mean, weirdly, part of this is like oddly linked to the narrative around Leeds. Like over Christmas, like we saw so much criticism and so much concern, you know, around Leeds and their style, which I didn't really understand, because Leeds actually had a pretty good winter period. And Leeds, I think, came up kind of knowing that they were going to get battered sometimes, and other times they were going to absolutely annihilate teams. And that's exactly what they've done. They're going to stay in the division. They're going to improve their squad. And I'm quite optimistic. Weirdly, you don't see the same criticism that much, at least in the mainstream media. You see it from Wolves fans about Wolves' style, which I think is really suffering this season. I mean, they've got in the league overall at the moment, they've got a goal difference of -6, which is pretty poor. They had a tough schedule over Christmas, admittedly. They had Spurs, they had United, they had Brighton away. But their numbers certainly have been slipping for a little while. And yes, they lost Jota in the summer. And yes, they lost Jimenez to injury. But in the summer when Jota went, they weirdly decided to replace him with a child, really, you know, a guy who's one for the future rather than somebody who can contribute right now. And when you look around their squad, I see lots of potential and lots of talent, but there's nobody who's really performing at the moment. Like, I agree with you about Pedro Neto. I think Pedro Neto is a great talent. He's got the best expected goals and assists per 90 at Wolves, 0.35. He and Jimenez are joint top scorers with 4 goals. That's really, really worrying to me. And I look at Wolves now, and only 6 teams in the league get fewer shots inside the box per game than they do. Only 6 teams. And more troublingly, the defence has really, really dropped off. Really dropped off. Like, they're pressing less than they were last season, and they're easier to press than they were last season. And I was looking at deep completions. So deep completions are passes into the zone within 20 meters of the opponent's goal that are not crosses. So basically, like, how often you let teams get established possession close to your goal. This is generally a good way to see how, like, how much pressure teams face, like, in their own final third. Last year, only United, Chelsea, Liverpool and City allowed fewer deep completions across the whole season than Wolves. Only those 4 teams. This year, Wolves are 5th bottom. So suddenly, teams are able to pin them back in a way that they weren't before. And that is really concerning. I can't quite work out why it is. Maybe it's Moutinho's lost a little step. You know, maybe it's Ruben Neves, who I think is now on his second season of kind of stagnation. Maybe it is the fact that they just can't get out because they don't have Jimenez to hold the ball up further up the pitch. But I don't know. Like, I'm a little bit worried about Wolves at the moment. And look, I'm not worried. The good thing is they're going to stay in the league. And so Fabio Silva will get time to develop and Jimenez will come back. And so from that point of view, their future's basically fine. But I think they've been poor this year. I think that they are probably 13th or 14th. Like, that's how I see them at the moment. That's what the underlying stats say. And I'm not terribly optimistic about things getting better unless Jimenez comes back in genuinely outstanding form. And at his age, without, you know, much of a preseason originally, and the number of minutes he's got in his legs over the last couple of years, I don't think there's a guarantee that he does that.
It's so difficult for Wolves because it's like, what? How do they go to the next level? And I don't think the signings in the summer necessarily took them to the next level. And I guess in their minds, next level is like consistent Europa League football, consistent top eight finishes. And I still don't think they're out of finishing the top eight, but the lack of a Raúl Jiménez in the team drops them probably from a top eight contender to sort of top 12. I think he's that big of a player for them. He's like, not only is he the goal scorer, but like you said, a huge outlet for how they want to play. Other than the Brighton game, I don't remember the last time they scored three goals. I'm just looking at some of the numbers here, and they haven't scored three goals prior to that Brighton game since July in 2020, which is worrying. So that narrative needs like sorting quickly, because when they sit deep and they are a defensive team, and Doogie can say it all he wants about how he likes to watch Wolves are one of the worst teams in the league to watch from entertainment point of view.
Yeah.
Like, they sit so deep. The games are so dry. They do look to hit you on the counter-attack. Adama Traore is a threat. But as like, he's back to having no end product. That's no goal in a full calendar year now. I just think that without Raúl Jiménez, they are a top 12 team. That's where they're going to finish. And it's a huge problem. I don't believe they're going to be able to keep Pedro Neto for another year. I'd be really shocked if he's not playing at a higher level come the summer. And it's that kind of constant revolving door, almost like Southampton a few years ago, where it's like, oh, how many times can they lose their best player? Jota goes. If Pedro Neto goes this year, Moutinho's a year older, how many times can they rejuvenate those positions before they do start to sink down the table? So I don't have a massive problem with Wolves. I just find them boring. And without Jiménez, they lose 80% of the way they want to play football.
I think they'll be able to keep Neto just because...
Really?
Because I think he's good when you're watching for him this season, but he's not having a great season, like with tons of goals and assists, enough that I think it will attract interest to the degree that would tempt Wolves to sell. Like, I don't think anyone's coming in with like 40 mil for Pedro Neto this summer. And I
really?
I
think teams will be.
When you consider, well, I don't know, like if you could get Jota for 45 mil last year, like do you go and spend nearly the same amount on Pedro Neto? Like, I'm not sure.
I think so.
I'm not sure I do right now. I think that probably what happens is that he has another season. Wolves are probably better next year because they'll go and spend in the summer. And then maybe he goes in the summer of 2022 after having like a breakout year. Because I think he's going to end this year with good numbers, but not like such insane numbers that like, I don't know, a Spurs would take interest or an Arsenal would take interest. But it's interesting, like that. The thing is, they've got so many dribblers. Like, there's no team in the league that's completed more dribbles or attempted more dribbles. But you'd expect that would make them exciting. It doesn't. And it also means that when you can face up their dribblers, you know, like when you've got guys who are just stopping Adama Traore from picking up speed, or when you've got a great one-on-one fullback, like, say, a Wan-Bissaka or someone versus a Pedro Neto or a Podence, then... they kind of aren't really able to get much traction. And Fabio Silva is surprisingly big for his age, but he's obviously not capable of doing the sort of hold-up play that you really need from a forward in that system currently.
But equally, if you're Nuno, like, you're pretty aware that whoever does, like, if you go and buy a January striker, like, when Jiménez is back, he gets benched.
Yeah.
He only plays with one up top anyway. So it's a bit of a difficult scenario. And like, it's hard to judge, isn't it? Because none of us know when Jiménez is going to be back. Is it going to be 3 weeks? Is it going to be 3 months? We can't put a timeline on it at the moment. So I think the January period for Wolves is going to be particularly interesting because they do have a little bit more money than some of the teams in the bottom half of the table. But I don't know how much they'd be willing to spend because of the Jiménez return.
Yeah, I think it's I don't think any of us have serious concern about Wolves, but I do think that they they're going to need some key positions. I do think they're going to need another forward, like, because of Jiménez's age. I think they're going to need another central midfielder. And generally speaking, if they don't go and do some clever business this summer, I wouldn't be surprised if they take a little step backwards. And given where they are now, a little step backwards could actually be a bit dangerous next year, because maybe we should talk about this. Like, you obviously, like, in the Football Daily WhatsApp group, like, you are very much banging the drum that there are no good teams in the Premier League this season.
Yeah.
And I kind of agree with you in that there's no team which is like as good as the top teams in the last few seasons. Mm. However, my argument is almost the opposite, which is that there are tons and tons of good teams. And I think that the problem this year is that the top teams have taken a small step backwards, but the teams beneath have taken a big step forwards. You know, so you look at how much better Villa are, and like even Leeds, who are like a bottom half of the table side, are really dangerous. Like, I think that now there are so many good teams that there are no outstanding teams.
It's an interesting one, because I do say about 60% of it to wind people up, but equally, I think my argument is more predicated around the fact, predicated, I don't even know if that's the right word, but based around the fact that I think the quality of football in the Premier League this year is really poor. Okay. Like I think the actual standards of games has seen a massive drop off, and I think that's probably partially to do with the volume of fixtures, COVID, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But I do believe the quality in the Premier League this year is pretty much the worst I can remember in like 5 or 6 years.
Maybe since the season Leicester won the league, that was a pretty bad.
Yeah, year. And I don't believe there are any really good teams this season in the Premier League. Like, I've watched Liverpool at times. I think they are really fantastic to watch. And then, they draw against Newcastle and draw against West Brom, two teams that are painfully poor. And I think, Liverpool last season, even like 3 or 4 years ago, Liverpool would have been walking over this side. City are coming together now, but at the start of the season, they looked pretty off the pace. Didn't look like Pep Guardiola's Man City, that's for sure. Like, Man United, exciting going forward, pretty dry at the back, I think. Pre-Eric Bailly looked woeful at the back. I think we conceded more goals than Fulham a couple of games ago. So, like, even the top teams, I think, don't look great. The middling teams keep dropping points consistently when they against each other and against relegation threatened sides. And even like Brighton, I almost wanted to put Brighton in my stock falling. Like, look, I love to banter Hamill about Brighton because he is so pro Potter and so pro Brighton. And obviously they play attractive football, but it comes to a point where underlying numbers are no longer good enough. Like, they actually have to start getting results because the slide down the table for Brighton is now getting concerning. Like, Fulham are in 18th, 3 points behind them and have 2 games in hand. I know that they are way better than the numbers suggest physically. And like, when you watch them, you're like, this is a good team. But at some point, it has to get real with the point situation. So I won't put Brighton in there, but I just like think of Brighton as like a really good example of this. Like, good team, but just don't win any games. Like, they're good to watch, but they just don't get results done.
Yeah, but then, I mean, in a way, Brighton are part of my argument, you know, that I think like this is a team that could potentially get relegated, which actually have like very decent numbers and are pretty decent to watch. Like, I agree about people being tired. And like I say, I agree that the top level is not what it was the last 3 years. But to me, the step forward that teams like Villa have taken,
Villa, I think, are a bit of a separate example. Though, like, I agree with you. I think Villa actually are significantly improved this season, and like maybe Everton, you could say the same thing
Everton
about.
Definitely, I think that probably.
But other than that, who else is improved?
Well, I think Leicester are at least as good. They've struggled from some serious injury problems. I think teams like Palace are certainly better than they were.
I'm not sure.
I think that Brighton are certainly better than they were last year, even though the results aren't there. I still think that they won't get relegated. I still think they're a pretty good side.
West Ham, I suppose you could say.
West Ham have definitely improved. I think West Ham are a genuinely pretty good side. So, I mean, it's not... The way I'd look at it is this. If you took the top 10 sides in the Premier League right now, or at the end of the season, and made them play the top 10 sides in the Premier League from, like, 3 years ago, I think that probably in places one and two, like, I think the teams from this year get beaten. But in places like 3 to 10, I'd actually argue that the teams this season are probably better than they were back then. Like maybe maybe not three, but I do think that like, is the 10th place team in the Premier League better now than it was 3 years ago? I think the 10th place team in the Premier League is probably better now than it's ever been. That's really how I'd look at it. So I kind of agree with you and disagree with you on like the no good teams. I feel like if anything, there are too many good teams, but no great teams. But that said, what you were talking about with quality last night, about 10 minutes into the Chelsea Man City game last night, I was like, I swear to God, there's been one completed pass in this game, and it was Rodri passing back to Zach Steffen that he picked up and gave away a free kick in the box.
Like, there's so many comedy moments, mate. Like the amount of times players are like tripping over the ball, passing it out of play, unable to head the ball. It's embarrassing.
Yeah. Do you have another stock falling before we move on to our final risings?
I think, like I as I've said, I'm not going to say Brighton potentially drawn in by Steve Bruce, who is almost the direct opposite of Brighton, isn't he? Like, I think his last four games have obviously been grim.
Yeah,
but. And they play horrendous football but pick up results. Like, not massive amounts of results, but just enough just to keep their head above water. Yeah. And I think Newcastle fans are pretty much at the point where they'd rather be drowning playing entertainment football than surviving playing this. Because it is bad to watch. Like, I think they've had the least touches in the box of any team by about 150, like, this season. And when Andy Carroll came on against Leicester and scored his first goal in a decade for Newcastle, I thought to myself, I can imagine Newcastle fans sat at home thinking, like, this is the end, surely. And obviously they're winless in their last four. So I think Steve Bruce has, in the last four, his stock is really getting hit pretty hard, especially amongst Newcastle fans. Mm-hmm. I think if you ask the average Newcastle fan on the street, do they still want Bruce as manager, they'd say no.
I do think, though, they've been a little bit of, to soften that a little bit, their most entertaining player is Alan Saint-Maximin, and obviously they've been without him because he's suffering with long COVID. And I kind of think Newcastle are terrible. I thought they were one of the worst teams in the league last year and were very lucky to stay up. And I do understand the frustration, but I also think you just hope to stay in the division and you can strengthen a little bit this summer and maybe things get a little bit better if Saint-Maximin recovers, if Jamal Lascelles comes back. But it is pretty bleak. I can sympathise with them because what had annoyed me with Arsenal over the last couple of months was less that we were getting bad results. Because there were periods, under Wenger, obviously, where we got terrible results. But I was just like, this is boring. Like, I'm giving up 2 hours of my week, of time that I could be doing something else to watch this. And it's boring. It's depressing.
Yeah, and I think that is probably where a lot of Newcastle fans are at. So I would have, kind of Brighton, Chelsea, Newcastle as my obvious ones. Because, Sheffield United, it's just too easy to talk about them, isn't it?
Yeah.
They are probably going to be the worst Premier League team ever. And West Brom, like, we've spoken about them a lot as well because Allardyce has now come in and conceded about 200 goals in his first four games. So there's not really much merit to speaking about them more. Whereas at least like Brighton, we've been really positive about Brighton throughout this season. And obviously, when you look at the wider context now, one home win in a calendar year, they've, I don't think, won their any of their last six. Can't score goals consistently enough, although they did score three against Wolves, but even then you were like at half time thinking, oh god, it's really looking bleak here for Potter. They need to get a striker in desperately, Brighton, in January.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Or Mopé needs to discover some form. Do you have a final stock rising before we move on to my last stock rising?
I'm giving my final stock rising. I'm torn here in my final stock rising.
Okay.
I want to give a shout out to Burnley because I think Sean Dyche has done a fantastic job in the last sort of 4 weeks over the Christmas period, picked up some huge results, draw with Everton, beat Arsenal, draw with Villa, beat Wolves, beat Sheffield United, and probably lift them high enough out of like immediate relegation danger. And I think with the takeover happening now, the funds being pumped into the club in January, they will end up being safe, which is a positive for Sean Dyche. So I do think stock is definitely rising at Burnley. I think the takeover propels them right up there with stock rising. But yeah, I want to give mine to Eric Bailly at Manchester United. I think Eric Bailly is potentially the key to Manchester United putting together a genuine title challenge. Because, quite frankly, without him at the back, it's a comedy procession. And at times with Bailly, it's a comedy procession as well, because he does have his moments of absolute madness, and you can guarantee one a game, be it like an overhead kick in his own box, a two-footed challenge, some disastrous, like, weird ball out to Rose Z. But overall, his impact on this Manchester United defence is almost immeasurable because of his athleticism to partner Maguire. I think they've played together 12 times, kept 9 clean sheets now, Maguire and Bailly. And when you have him in the team, he covers for nearly all of Maguire's frailties. And Maguire has positives. I speak about him a lot. You know, passing out from the back, he's very good at, very consistent, excellent in the air. But he's extremely slow, extremely immobile, and at times is also prone to a lapse of concentration, which is often where Lindelof isn't fast enough, isn't athletic enough to cover for him. And we've seen United get exposed time and time again on the break with those two at centre-back. Eric Bailly, you get the pace, you get the athleticism, wins a huge amount of aerial duels. And when teams are breaking on United and it's a 2-on-2, I back Eric Bailly to have the pace, almost like Aaron Wan-Bissaka, to cover for what Maguire won't give you. So if you can keep him fit, United will have a very good second half of the season. If he gets injured, I think you'll see United drop off pretty quickly, because he gets injured so much, Eric Bailly. He's almost like a sort of Joel Matip figure where you can't guarantee 10 games in a row out of him. But I think he's had an exceptional Christmas period, and the block against Aston Villa was classic Eric Bailly. And Man United are actually putting together a pretty solid spell at the moment. Pretty sure we'll lose to City in the Carabao tomorrow after watching them against Chelsea. But do you know what? I'm fairly happy with where United are at the moment and the progression that's happening under Solskjaer.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair enough. Like, I think Man United have really found some form, despite, I think, still some glaring issues, you know, in their squad, in their starting 11. But that said, there was a moment where I was like, is Eric Bailly about to get sent off in that Villa game? You remember he took a touch, and I think the whistle had already gone, which I think is why he got a yellow. He took a heavy touch.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely two-sided through someone.
Absolutely ridiculous, like no need for it either. But you know, with Bruno in the team, it's always like United are always gonna create chances and always gonna have moments in games. And from his arrival to this point, no Premier League team has taken more points than Manchester United, despite the fact that everybody calls us one of the most inconsistent teams in the league. United are right up there with sort of a Liverpool and Manchester City as sort of the top three points gathering teams of 2020. So do you know what? As long as Bruno's fit and Eric Bailly's fit at the back, United are going to stand a chance.
No, well, I'm intrigued to see where they end up, because I think, like, weirdly, I've become sort of like a bit of a Solskjaer defender. Should we move on to final stock rising? Because I've just realised this has been a long one, man. But we kind of needed to do some Man United content for the fans, I think. So my final stock rising is Emile Smith Rowe.
Yes, finally.
Yeah, well, I mean,
you've been banging that drum, mate, for 6 months. I'm absolutely delighted for you that it's finally started to make a sound.
Thank you very much. Well, in the summer, yeah, I wrote a list of potential breakouts for this season. That was back in September, and I put Emile Smith Rowe on it.
Yeah.
And I said at the time, this is less about how amazing I think he is, though he was certainly highly rated as a prospect. And it's more about the fact that Arsenal have such an obvious, huge vacancy at attacking midfield. And so often what you see with big sides, is that when a young player comes through, it's because that team has a particular vacancy there, right? And so we expected him to play a bit more, but was recovering from that shoulder injury. And I think I could have put Saka in here, but I think his reputation was probably one of the few at Arsenal to survive that horrible run through the autumn. Definitely. I could have put Lacazette in here, who was the top scorer over Christmas with 4 goals, top scorer in the league. Arsenal, in fact, the only team in the Premier League over Christmas to win, to have a 100% win rate. They won all three of their matches. And I think the jury remains out on Arteta, but these performances from Emile Smith-Rowe have been really, really positive. Like putting someone between the lines, but not just someone between the lines, because Arsenal have played Joe Willock there, they've played Lacazette there. But Smith-Rowe's pace means that he can dovetail quite nicely with Saka. He's pretty creative. He's already got the most chances created per 90 of any Arsenal player this season. Four shot creating actions per 90, which is the best in the squad by miles and would rank, I think, about 16th in the league, kind of between Pedro Neto, Sadio Mane. That's where it would be.
It's good.
But yeah, I think he's just been really, really impressive. Like, he's got great match intelligence. He was obviously at the centre of Arsenal scoring that fantastic goal against West Brom, which is probably one of about two fantastic goals Arsenal scored in the whole of 2020.
That was a great goal, though, wasn't it? It was a 20-pass sequence, I think, in the build-up to that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real Wenger-type goal. And he's working really hard as well, pressing. And now you're hearing, you know, Arsenal were linked with a move for Isco. I still think Arsenal should probably go and get an attacking midfielder in the January window. But rumours are that they're kind of changing their mind about how obvious a starter they want that person to be because of the form of Smith Rowe. And I think that's totally fair enough. You know, since he's come in, it's only three games. And two of those against relegation candidates. Though Arsenal have also got Palace and Newcastle left, so that also means they could potentially rack up some more points there. But 16 shots a game since Smith Rowe came in, compared to 11.4 a game across the season. Like, that's really, really good. And already, you know, Arsenal fans are calling him Kevin De Croydon, which is a pretty amazing...
That's great, though, isn't it?
It's a pretty amazing nickname.
I think
nickname.
Bukayo Saka commented Kev on one of his Instagram photos most recently. So
yeah, Croydon Kev. I don't know, it's just a nice feel-good story in a season that hasn't really had a lot of them for Arsenal. And he just looks... It's not just that he's playing in the right zone. It's that he also has... I don't think he's been, like, outstanding in any of those games. But I think he's intelligent and he knows where to be.
Yeah, and also, like, he has a natural and, like, historic link with Bukayo Saka having come through, like, age groups with him. He knows where he's going to be almost. And I think, do you know what about Bukayo Saka? I think he's finally found a potential home at right wing. He was obviously playing left wing, left back, left wing back. There was chat about could he play in central midfield. I think finally we've kind of decided, okay, right wing is the place for Bukayo Saka right now. And it's going to come at the detriment to Nicolas Pepe, but I honestly don't think a single Arsenal fan cares. At this stage, whereas this time last year, there were still probably Arsenal fans that were going, oh, it can't keep Pepe out of a team. Like, it's got to get them both in there. Now I think every Arsenal fan probably just thinks, I don't care whether he's in there with him or not. So I think Emile Smith-Rowe, I would agree with you. Bukayo Saka as well. I think Arteta as a whole has had a good like month or so, at least last three games, which is about a week in modern football. But yeah, I would agree. Like stock rising, Arsenal, Emile Smith Rowe, Kieran Tierney as well. Just generally much, much better, isn't it?
Yeah, I think to be honest, like the ceiling for Arsenal is probably still eighth or ninth. Like I don't think that they're really realistically going to get above that unless there's some huge improvement and they go on a great hot streak or like Martinelli explodes or something. But I agree about Saka, man of the match in two of Arsenal's last three fixtures. And in the third, he scored that great goal against West Brom. And Arsenal have started creating some big chances again. I think in the Brighton game before the West Brom match, there was a chance that Saka created for Aubameyang that Aubameyang missed. It was from about three yards out. And it was the biggest chance Arsenal had created for Aubameyang in the whole of 2020.
Yeah, mate, I saw a great stat actually that against West Brom you had 12 shots on target. That's the most shots on target in a single game for Arsenal since Wenger.
Yeah. And it's not surprising. Mad. You know, like when you watch us, like it's not surprising. Like that West Brom game, it was like a completely different side. But you now look at that attacking band and you think, okay, you know, Danny Ceballos was unbelievable against West Brom as well. But you think, you know what? You've got Martinelli or Aubameyang, Smith Rowe and Saka. And Smith Rowe's fast enough that he can pull out to the wing and interchange with Saka. And you think, you know what? You pop in Gabriel in the back line, who's obviously been out with COVID. You put Partey in the midfield. Yeah. And I don't think you've got an outstanding side. I don't think you've got a European level side, but I think that you've got something cooking and you've got a decent prospect for the future. So I think Arsenal should still be looking to strengthen, but I think Smith Rowe complicates their plans there. You know, you don't necessarily want to go and get a 10 now who's just going to completely bench him. You want to go and get someone who can maybe at times play wide and Smith Rowe could play through the middle. Or I think that's how good he's been.
Well, you're not going to go and get Isco now, are you?
I don't think so. But if we got Isco, it would be a loan anyway. But I mean, yeah, I think that if I were looking at it now, I'd say, you know what? Like, do we go and get... I think Arsenal really desperately need to upgrade their forward line. But yeah. I'd be less inclined to say, okay, we need to go and get a starting 10. We need to go and get a starting left winger who are just going to bench, you know, Martinelli and Smith Rowe. I think I'd want somebody who could play with them, who could maybe... play it forward if Martinelli plays on the left, or play it left if Martinelli plays a forward who could play
on
the wing.
So what would be your ideal lineup right now? Martinelli left, Emile Smith Rowe in the 10, Bukayo on the right, and then do you think Lacazette is kind of earned in the last 4 weeks the 9 spot?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not even about that. It's that I think that Lacazette fits those players a little bit more. Like, he's much more of a natural link-up guy. Than those people are. And the great thing about that side is pretty much everyone can drop into a different position and interchange.
I agree.
I mean, that said, this is something that Arteta has a reputation for, right? That he can figure out that he, at Man City, the one thing that everyone kind of had concrete evidence of was his ability to develop players and work on their relationships and how they dovetailed in different positions. So my hope would be that he can work out a way for Martinelli and Aubameyang to interchange. But we're yet to see it. And so right now, I think, like, it's fine to keep playing Lacazette. I'd probably still be thinking about selling at least one of those strikers in the summer. But for right now, like, it seems to be working. I think you probably stick with it until it stops working.
Yeah, I agree. I think Arsenal well deserving of being our stock on the rise.
Yeah, nice, man. Well, I think that just about wraps us up for this week. We've had basically an hour. So, I mean, there's a good New Year's present for everyone.
100%, mate. I mean, like, that was one of the most enjoyable podcasts I've been involved in 2021, I have to be said, seeing as this is the first one I've been involved in.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You didn't have to say the last bit. I worked out that it was a dig. But is there anything that you'd like to point to before we wrap up?
Why not come and check us out on Snapchat? Download Snapchat, re-download it. You're probably too old for it, but get it back because, you know, we do content on there every single day.
Yeah, well, that, what an incredible advert that was. Thanks very much for watching / listening. Make sure that you're subscribed to us either as a podcast or on our channel, Football Daily Podcast. And hopefully we will catch you next time. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.